as a business to develop a corporate conscience, not only domestically, but around the world, especially where we buy coffee. So to hit Starbucks, really, we have to question why.
That's so interesting, Ian Bell. In this last 30 seconds, we just covered a protest outside Starbucks in Brooklyn. Tomorrow, a major one outside the Empire State Building. Mahmoud Mamdani, right? Zohran Mamdani, the mayor-elect of New York City, and Bernie Sanders were both there. The significance of 26 years ago and today as we end this conversation.
These issues haven't gone away. I think what's been fascinating for us as we made the film, we could see so many of the issues that are galvanizing the youth movements and other movements that are trying to reform or change the direction of the Democratic Party. They were there and filling the streets 26 years ago. And the power structure at the time didn't listen to the people then. I hope that they begin to listen to them now.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ian Bell, director of the new documentary WTO 99, and longtime corporate critic Ralph Nader. WTO 99 starts screening Friday at DCTV's Firehouse Cinema here in New York. I'll be hosting a Q&A with Ian after the 7:30 screening. Also, tomorrow, December 4th, Thursday, I'll be doing the Q&A after the 7:30 screening of Steal the Story, Please, about Democracy Now's 30 years. At the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor at the Hamptons Doc Fest there. Happy birthday.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
This is our KBOO Fights Back campaign. KBOO knows the importance of community media when we need it most. Help us reach our goal of $75,000 by December 31st. Join KBOO Community Radio for an in-person meet and greet at the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Stop by KBOO on Saturday, December 6th or Sunday, December 7th from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. Meet radio hosts and producers, members of the board of directors, and fellow KBOO community members. Enjoy coffee or tea and light refreshments, take a tour of the station, and make your year-end donation in person. For more information about KBOO Fights Back in-person events, visit kboo.fm/in-person2025. Thank you for supporting KBOO Community Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of KBOO Evening News, an Oregon lawsuit against the Trump administration attempts to restore SNAP benefits for immigrants and asylum seekers.
Local Starbucks workers stay out on strike.
And in national Native news, November employment numbers decreased.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 3rd, 2025. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to encourage you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Danny Shai. Oregon is in another lawsuit against the Trump administration over SNAP. They argue that new rules cutting off food assistance benefits for green card holders is a violation of federal law. There are 22 states in this coalition lawsuit over a memo from the end of October telling states to cut off SNAP for certain groups of legal immigrants. The memo references the eligibility changes as part of the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act. But the plaintiffs say the memo incorrectly makes everyone who enters the country through humanitarian pathways permanently ineligible for SNAP, even in the event they become legal permanent residents. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield said his office thought the memo must be a mistake when it first came out. Rayfield, in a written statement, called on the feds to clarify their position or withdraw and correct their memo. Rayfield's office says the USDA has not replied. Rayfield has asked the federal district court in Eugene to intervene. Changes to recipient eligibility is just one of the new restrictions for the SNAP program under the One Big Beautiful Bill. New rules began going into effect this fall that will make qualifying for benefits more difficult and will require states to bear more of the cost and take on more of the administrative burden.
Portland City Council passed the detention facility impact fee on a vote of 9-2 at their meeting this morning. It was brought by councilors Annalita Murillo and Mitch Green. It will add a new fee on to private landlords who rent their buildings out as detention facilities. Detention facilities like the ICE facility on Southwest McAdam Avenue have big impacts on the surrounding community and on the city, which has to respond to it. That includes things like police overtime, traffic management, emergency response, and environmental cleanup from chemical weapons like tear gas. The sponsors of the ordinance say their fee would help make sure it's not just Portland taxpayers that carry the burden of these facilities. The impact fee structure wouldn't impact the ICE facility in Southwest just yet. It kicks in only in the process of a lease renegotiation or renewal. But that's not the only thing that new ordinance does. It also creates nuisance standards that, when violated, add fines. That would be for things like environmental cleanup for the surrounding neighborhoods if there's been extensive use of chemical agents like tear gas. Those standards would allow the city to respond right away. In a FAQ, or Frequently Asked Questions document, the councilors write that the structure is to protect against future detention facilities that could be built. The two no votes came from councilors Dan Ryan and Steve Novick. Ryan said he had early concerns that the ordinance would hurt efforts to build behavioral health research centers. That wouldn't be impacted in the case, but he still ended up voting against it.
At this moment, I got to tell you, I'm torn because my heart aches about the actions of this administration and the behaviors of the feds, the ICE agents, towards innocent families being torn apart. Yet this comes across as a high visibility with low impact policy in a resource strapped environment. And as you all know, I tend to be a no on such things. Further, on the surface, this legislation will penalize a private property owner for federal actions without truly tackling the real problem, which is to keep our immigrant community members safe and ensure that they have the services they need. Yet, since two things can be true, it also supports the REACH housing facility, and those residents really deserve our support. I'm torn on my vote and appreciate the efforts to improve this legislation as it has evolved, and I do appreciate that.
Councillor Novick had reservations too, particularly surrounding intellectual consistency.
I've gone back and forth about whether to support this. I really appreciate the creativity and the intent. My concern is that I feel like if I were going to vote for this, I'd be voting for the principle that if a facility winds up generating lots of protests against it, then the costs of the city's cost of dealing with those protests should be assessed to the landowner through a fee. And I think that if I adopted that principle, then I would be saying that if I were a city councilor in a city with an abortion clinic and lots of protests against the abortion clinic and lots of police overtime, et cetera, set to deal with those protests, then I would have to support a fee assessed against the abortion clinic for the costs of dealing with those protests. And I know that I wouldn't do that because then I'd be sort of inviting, if there's enough protest against the abortion clinic and enough city costs, then the abortion clinic will have to pay, won't be able to pay those, then have to shut down. So I also want to note that if this fee/nuisance ordinance were totally limited to costs associated with a list of chemical agents, then I wouldn't have the same concerns and I'd be okay with that. But I just wanted to state that, I mean, maybe I'm like, being unduly obsessed with intellectual consistency, but that's my concern.
Here's how one of the sponsors, Murillo, responded.
I mean, I think that the purpose of this policy is to address the externalities that are caused by the facility, not by other things that are happening, right? So with the ICE facility, or with other detention facilities, we are specifically seeing unique harms that are being caused by, for example, excessive use of tear gas. I would say that at an abortion clinic, they don't have the manpower or the ability to tear gas the neighborhood. So I don't think that would apply. I appreciate the concern, because obviously I would be concerned about the same thing. But I do think that legislative intent also matters when we're passing policy. And I think we've been abundantly clear about what the purpose of this is.
That was Portland City Councilor Annalita Murillo speaking out about the detention center impact fee that passed this morning.
Unionized Starbucks workers from across Portland metro area say they will stay on strike until Starbucks resolves complaints about its labor practices and returns to the bargaining table. Roughly 2,000 workers at 95 unionized Starbucks locations across the country have been on strike since mid-November. Starbucks, with over 9,000 stores nationwide and over 3,000 employees, made over $25 billion in profits in 2024 and has a long history of union busting. Seven of those Starbucks stores are located in Portland area, while two stores in Eugene have joined the strike as well. The strike coincides with Starbucks' famed Red Cup Day, which is among the company's most lucrative events of the year. Labor Radio's Laura Wadlin spoke with Aspen Maxwell and Maggie Bolden of Starbucks Workers Union, who say they turned the company's Red Cup Day into Red Cup Rebellion Day.
One of the reasons why Starbucks workers are so motivated with their organizing is because a lot of us, myself included, you know, quit my career job and worked at Starbucks because I heard that it was the best job in retail, where you could work part-time and get health benefits. And then you kind of quickly realize that that's not actually true. That's not the case. And that, like too many other service jobs, it's still not a living wage and it's still exploitative work. So I think we were kind of bamboozled by the company's marketing saying that this is the best job in retail, that we offer all these perks and benefits, only to find that they are still giving us pennies and not enough to live on.
That was Aspen and Maggie with Starbucks Workers Union United. The union has prepared workers to go on strike for a long haul. They say they've been working towards this moment for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Penny is not enough to live on. And I think on top of that, you know, they like to claim about the benefits and the access to benefits, but then they make it really hard to access those benefits in pretty much any way that they can find, whether it's preventing people from maintaining those hours on a consistent basis or holding it behind other access barriers that make it hard to be able to receive the care, like healthcare, that we want to receive.
Why is the struggle of Starbucks workers so important to the rebirth and growth of the labor movement?
I think that Starbucks has been the face for happy consumerism for a long time, definitely as long as I've been alive. People have kind of unquestionably loved Starbucks and said, hey, you know, it's a huge chain, but I like the coffee they make, and I've heard that they treat their workers well. So I think this moment of Starbucks, having the name recognition, the brand recognition, and then also I think that honestly lends itself pretty well to our union effort, because people know about Starbucks. Anywhere I go and I tell them I work at Starbucks, people know what that means. And when I say that they're violating the law, they're not paying us fairly, everyone's like, wait, that's not what I have heard of Starbucks through the years. That's not what I have known. And so I think in that way, Starbucks having this labor uprising has really kind of become the face of the labor movement in the last few years, and really helped lend itself to our cause and to our awareness.
Bolden says contract negotiators came very close to finalizing the contract, saying they were about 90% there. She says Starbucks refuses to bargain about wages and safe and secure staffing. Those are really the two things we need to finalize in the contract.
Oregon and 19 other states just got stiffed by the Department of Homeland Security and the Trump administration because of its state sanctuary laws. Early into the second term, Trump gave states an ultimatum: either cooperate with immigration enforcement or lose federal Homeland Security funding. A federal judge ruled in September the Department of Homeland Security couldn't attach such strings to its grants that states use for counterterrorism and emergency planning. For the state of Oregon, that equates to just about $18 million that, in past, has paid for everything from bomb detectors to security analyst salaries. Despite the ruling, the Trump administration has dangled the grant money just out of reach of the sanctuary states. They now require states to estimate how many people they've deported in the state and shorten the deadline for spending the grant money. That's been a tough standard to match since the Department of Homeland Security is the agency to have those numbers, and they haven't given them out to states. Without the money, Oregon officials say two-thirds of the counties won't be able to pay for basic emergency management and preparedness work. These grants were first created in the wake of 9/11 and were strictly for counterterrorism purposes. In the years since, cities and states have used the funds for general emergency preparedness. That includes more advanced technology like drones used for investigating arson by the Portland Fire Bureau and the fire suppression devices that prevented widespread harm at two attempted bombings of ballot drop boxes in the metro area in 2024.
Tennessee holds a surprisingly close special election. North Carolina can use newly drawn congressional maps, and court practices in Ohio and Alabama bring calls for reform. With that story and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm super excited of the momentum that we have to have the endorsement of the president, and we're going to win decisively. This is about the direction we want to move our country, and we want to move it in the America First direction.
Republican Matt Van Epps, ahead of Tuesday's special election in Tennessee's 7th Congressional District, which has been solidly Republican for over a decade. His Democratic opponent campaigned on affordability, a winning message in Virginia, New Jersey, and New York City. Van Epps won by a modest margin, which could be another sign of voters souring on President Donald Trump's economic policies ahead of next year's midterms. A federal court says North Carolina can use a new congressional map in 2026. The Voting Rights Act forbids using redistricting for racial discrimination, but the judges ruled that plaintiffs hadn't proven the map wasn't just drawn to advantage the GOP. Deborah Maxwell with the NAACP of North Carolina says it's the same thing, and the new districts clearly weaken black voting power in the eastern part of the state.
It's really odd that they would say that they did not choose it because of race, but you chose the area to eliminate a potential black congressperson, which that area has had for decades.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says he was not there when a U.S. admiral gave the order which killed the survivors of a previous strike on an alleged drug boat, but he defends the order. A bipartisan group in Congress says that may have been a war crime. A municipality near Cleveland is charging some residents with crimes if they have unpaid parking tickets. Investigative reporter Mark Puente says the practice stands out compared with other places.
I've been to courthouses all over the country. I've never seen people being arraigned in criminal court for a parking ticket. I could see if he had 12 of them or something, and even that's extreme, but they're civil infractions.
Reform advocates say turning a civil fine into a criminal matter can trap people in debt and a cycle of court cases. A missed payment can lead to additional fees, a suspended license, or even an arrest warrant. In Alabama, a new analysis shows court fines can keep people tied to the system long after their case is resolved. Researcher Leah Nelson looked at 5 years of Jefferson County data and says the structure often works against people trying to get back on their feet.
That's not a good way to raise revenue, and it's also unjust to punish people in a way that they'll never be done with, because we now have evidence that a very large number of people just never finish paying.
Lawmakers reviewing the fee structure say they want to rebalance accountability with more realistic chance of repayment, in part to reduce the backlog of unpaid court debt. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a new member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be getting the latest from reporters at Street Roots and Oregon Arts Watch. At 6, it's the Student Hour. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 39 degrees. And tomorrow, look for rainy with a high of 48. Today in history, in 1901, President Teddy Roosevelt delivered a 20,000-word speech to Congress to curb the power of industry trusts. The quote of the day is from Polish-British novelist Joseph Conrad, who wrote, quote, "I can't tell if a straw ever saved a drowning man, but I know that a mere glance is enough to make despair pause. For in truth, we who are creatures of impulse are not creatures of despair."
Hundreds of First Nations leadership, chiefs, knowledge keepers, elders, youth, women, and Two-Spirit LGBTQIA+ people from across Canada gathered in Ottawa for the Assembly of First Nations Chief 2025 conference to advance shared priorities and strengthen their path forward. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canada's Assembly of First Nations Chiefs have voted unanimously to reject any changes to the oil tanker ban off the northern coast of British Columbia. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the resolution came during a First Nations meeting in Ottawa and less than a week after the federal government and Alberta signed a memorandum of understanding about a future pipeline.
The chiefs also voted in favor of requesting that Ottawa withdraw the memorandum, saying it could pave the way for a new pipeline through BC. The national chief of the AFN, Cindy Woodhouse-Nepinak, says Native leaders are united.
Canada can create all the MOUs, project offices, advisory groups that they want. The chiefs are united. When it comes to approving large national projects on First Nations lands, there will not be getting around rights holders.
Prime Minister Mark Carney also addressed the AFN meeting, saying he plans to meet with coastal British Columbia First Nations. Merle Alexander is a lawyer who represents two of those bands.
First Nations in Canada are feeling overwhelmed, that they're feeling as though there is the duty to consult is being undermined. There also is a real pushback against this regression on environmental and climate change policies.
Last week, Carney and Alberta Premier Danielle Smith signed a memorandum of understanding to cooperate on energy. That opens the way for an exemption from the coastal tanker ban to support a new pipeline to the West Coast and easier access for Canadian oil to Asian markets. The ban has been in place for about 50 years. It bars oil tankers carrying more than 12,500 tons of crude oil from stopping or unloading at ports from the north end of Vancouver Island to Alaska. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
For 5 days, the Indian National Finals Rodeo is held in October in Las Vegas. The older generation passes the torch as up-and-coming riders compete for a shot at a world title. KNPR's Jimmy Romo attended the rodeo and has this story.
Behind the bucking chute at the Indian National Finals Rodeo in Las Vegas, or INFR, young riders suit up in their protective gear. There's a good chance a 2,000-pound bull could step on them after they hit the ground. Rodeo hands funnel the bull from their pens to the chute through a series of gates. Then they set them one by one to let the rider get on. When it's time, the gates open, and the animals buck repeatedly, trying to throw the rider off its back. A junior bull rider has to hold on to a bull with one hand for at least 6 seconds to score points. Cassius Thomas, who's 17, held on long enough to secure his win in the Junior Bull Riding INFR World Championship.
Well, I just love the feeling, love the adrenaline, and sure love the money.
Cassius's father, Daniel Thomas, 52, was also a bull rider in his youth. Both are enrolled members of the Navajo Nation.
all of the Navajo Nation, I believe this is the way of life, given the horses, the livestock, the sheep. So it all goes back to that.
Children are inspired by watching their older relatives participate in the sport. That was the case for Cassius. It was also the case for bronc rider Ethan Heisman-Yazzie. The 18-year-old finished at the top of his category to win the Rookie Saddle Bronc Riding INFR World Championship. Daniel Thomas was in the stands watching other junior bull riders get thrown before scoring any points. Then it was time to watch Cassius take his turn.
World champion Cassius Thomas!
The feeling of while the bull was bucking, I could kind of anticipate what it felt like. So I was moving like back and forth, and I was like moving around like I was dancing or something.
Ethan and Cassius will go home with belt buckles and cash prizes, making the trip to Vegas worth the gamble.
That was Jimmy Romo reporting, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Private employment in the U.S. decreased by 32,000 jobs last month, according to a new report from the company ADP. This is the third decline in private employment in the last 4 months. After UPW rather upwardly revised 47,000 increase in October, economists had forecast private employment rising by 10,000 jobs. The ADP data showed widespread job losses, which were concentrated among small businesses, which cut 120,000 jobs, even as larger firms added employees. Nella Richardson, ADP's chief economist, said, quote, "It is those mom-and-pop Main Street companies, firms, small businesses, and establishments that are really weathering what is an uncertain macro environment and a cautious consumer. I see them as a canary in the coal mine." The Labor Department's Bureau of Labor Statistics will release its employment report for November on December 16th, an 11-day delay attributed to the recently ended federal government shutdown. The lack of official data that has contributed to disagreement among policymakers at the Federal Reserve about how to weigh the risk of a weakening labor market against the possibility of worsening inflation.
In many states, car makers are prohibited from selling directly to consumers. Cutting out the middleman could help speed EV adoption. Dr. Anthony Lizowith has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The vast majority of new cars in the U.S. are sold through dealerships. And in many states, laws to protect dealerships prohibit car companies from selling their vehicles without that middleman.
Some of them outright ban or prohibit direct sales of vehicles to consumers. Others offer limited access.
Hannah Buds is with the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association, a group that's advocating for more electric vehicles in the state. In North Carolina, direct-to-consumer sales, for example at a retail showroom or online, are mostly prohibited. Only Tesla has qualified for an exception. Bud says these restrictions limit the growth of EVs in the state because they reduce consumer choice. In fact, some EV brands are simply unavailable in North Carolina.
So in order to enable access to EVs for all consumers, they really do need more options and price points to choose from.
So her group is pushing for policies that allow more direct-to-consumer EV sales. Bud says it's a common-sense solution that will benefit consumers and accelerate the transition to a clean energy future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael thinks Trump increasing power grab. I'll start this again. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael thinks Trump's increasing power grab is out of this world.
Most Republicans in D.C. seem okay with our military destroying alleged drug boats in international waters, but a couple aren't so sure about going back a second time to kill any survivors. The cost of each of those 20 or more illegal attacks could feed how many tens of thousands of people? Donald Trump wants to stop non-existent drug trafficking from Venezuela while he's just pardoned a convicted decades-long drug king. You know, that pardon and many others from Trump was paid for, but there'll be no federal investigation. Like there's no official questioning of how Trump was able to destroy the White House East Wing. He doesn't own the place, he's not even paying rent, and now he's supervising construction. America's gone from a democracy to a kleptocracy, government by thieves. Don't know if there's a word for government by vampire parasites, sucking out the government's fiscal blood while collapsing it from within, like a black hole, emitting no light or hope, consuming everything that comes near, history, science, a livable future. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Hannah Francis. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, Dr. Anthony Lizowith, and Farah Siddiqui. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Hannah Francis. Today is a special episode of Street Roots Radio, as is this edition of Street Roots. It is the fall anthology of the paper,